I'm Emerson Gilmore. I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic.
Hi.
Bring your greetings from all the good AAs, Al-Anons, and Alateens from the Roanoke Valley. What a weekend this has been for the rare mood I'm in. I know what they are talking about when they say they feel these vibes, when these love things coming from you beautiful people. This has been truly one of the highlights of my life. I want to thank the committee for inviting me and my lovely wife here. This has got to be one of the triple crowns. You know, in horse racing, you got the Kentucky Derby, you got the Belmont, and then you got some other biggie up there. But I believe that this Atlantic Roundup has got to rate near the top. And I want to congratulate this committee. George and his lovely wife and all of the others that had anything to do with this. This is really a class act. You know, I love all of you all so much, I want to share this morning my strength and hope with all of you. But I too want to share with you everything. I could not go home with this beautiful gift. Ramon and I talked about it without allowing you all to see what this committee gave us just for being here. Ramona and I, Ramona and I want to personally thank you to let you all know who frequent this fabulous Atlanta Roundup, that you really got some class people on this committee. And I want to thank you. I want to thank you. And I want to thank you for a second time for allowing me to add some color to this great event. You know, ever since Thursday that I heard my friend Keith. It had been 8 years since I saw Keith. We were together out in the Texas Roundup in Amarillo. But from that time on, and I heard Keith share, I knew that this was going to be a great convention. And then on Friday, married a beautiful lady from California. She won all of our hearts. And then on Saturday, that beautiful lady, that beautiful Indian maid, brought us and let us alcoholics know what we actually did to our loved ones. And to let us know they too were sick people. Ramona, I love you. Thank you. And then on Saturday night, that elder statesman from the from the state of Virginia. You know, Virginia's well represented here, Julian. But that's the elder statesman. Julian and I go back a long ways. Blackstone was the first retreat that I ever attended, and Julian was there. And I've been able through the years in my groin to listen to Julia in his unique way of expressing his rationale about this program, and it has helped me and continue to help me. We'll talk more about that junior when we get back home. But you know, a lot of people last night said to me, M said, you got a hard act to follow. After those alignment of speakers that this committee so wisely chose. I want to publicly tell you this morning, I disagree. I think it was necessary for me to hear these people share their experience, strength, and hope in order to get upon this spiritual high that I am this morning. After listening to them, I want you to know I feel good this morning like an ex-drunk should. I feel like I can fly high as an eagle. I'm okay as long as I remember that it's AA and God working through people like you that provide the wind beneath my wings. I want to place an imaginary cake in front of this rostrum this morning. And I want to believe that every speaker before me made a layout to that cake. And I believe that Romana and Julian put the icing on that cake Saturday. And this morning God has given me an assignment to add something to that cake. What it would be, I don't know, but we'll see. You know, when I came through those doors, my first AA meeting, I was a sick, sick dude. You know, I had this terrible insidious disease we call alcoholism, but I also had another disease, and I like to call it poor old me-ism. Seems like somebody knows something about that. But I was ed up with this poor old me-ism. And let me share with you two of my favorite poor old me-isms. One of my favorite poor old me-isms that kept me drunk for years was the fact that I was born a little bastard child. Oh, yes, this morning I can talk about it and laugh about it. But back 67 years ago in Greensboro, it wasn't popular to be born a bastard child. It was a traumatic experience. But you know, since I came into this fabulous program and traveled around this country sharing, I find it ain't too bad about being a bastard. Ain't nothing bad about it. Because I find out there's a whole lot of y'all running out there, around out there. And you know, I got just a little resentment this morning, and let me get rid of it quickly. Because I want to grow spiritually and stay on this spiritual high. You know, I got a little resentment against you white people. Because it's so easy for you all to be bastards. You know, all of y'all look basically the same. But it was tough on old M. Gilmer down in Greensboro 67 years ago. Because there was 10 of us in our family and then none of us look alike. You know, I had a sister that looked like an Indian. like my friend here. She had olive skin and long hair. Then I had a set of twins that looked like Chinamen. They had squinty eyes. And then I had a brother, he looks like some of them Arabs. Beautiful people. And he had this long hair and dark eyebrows. And then come M, the 10th child, the little black one. And Mama used to parade us up and down the streets of Greensboro. And everybody in that town knows something funny was going on down Lula's house. And they used to tease me. And boy, did it hurt. Boy, how cruel it was when they used to tease me and ask me about my father. Another one of my favorite poor me's was the fact that I was born black. You see, it wasn't popular to be born black 67 years ago down in Greensboro. Especially if you was a loudmouth, arrogant black. You see, the sheriff and his deputies soon let old M know, my kind wasn't liked around there. But you know, I came into this fabulous program and started to travel around this vast country of ours. And I started to notice the young people saying, black is beautiful. And I said, gee, they must be sick. But everywhere I'd go, I would hear him say, black is beautiful. So one day I decided to go check on this thing. So I went in my house and got before my full-length mirror. And I pulled off all of my clothes. And you know it didn't take me long to agree with them. And you know, since I found out that black was beautiful, I've been very careful how I wash my face. I want to leave it like it is. And one other thing, you know, it was so stupid of me to stay drunk all of those years because I was a bastard and because I was black. Because this morning I know that you beautiful people in this fabulous program can care less whether I'm a bastard or not. You can care less whether I'm black or not. The only requirement for old M to be a part of this fabulous fellowship is that I have a desire to stop drinking. Thank you, AA. And I thank all of you all. This morning, I'm truly, truly, truly on a spiritual high. You know, very early in my drinking, the God that I found in this program, I find out even though I left him, he never left me. Because he showed me at a very early age, when I first started to drink, that alcohol was no good for me. I was a big fella. I was a pretty fat athlete. I was the type of guy that could do it all. Football, baseball, swim like a fish. But I found out at age 17 that this newfound drug that I had accepted as my friend was no good for me. And it was during the football season down there in Greensboro, up there in Greensboro. And it's we were in a situation where we had won 10 straight games. And I was a star running back. And we were supposed to go down to Charlotte to play Charlotte, North Carolina, to see who was going to play Durham in the East for the state championship. And the day before we were supposed to leave, I made a deal with the water boy. His name was Pee-wee. You see, Pee-wee was a little bitty fellow, too small to play sports. So he had made his career being the water boy and the general manager on the basketball and baseball team. And I called Pee-wee and I said, tomorrow when I come here, Pee-wee, I'm going to bring a little vinegar bottle and it's going to have a miracle drug in it. And you're to take that miracle drug and put it in the water bucket under the towel. And when we go in at halftime, in case I need it, I'll wink at you, Pee-wee, and you'll follow me. We went to Charlotte that next day. It was in November, and it was cold. And the first half, it seems like Dudley High could do nothing right. The other team seemed to be having all the breaks. And we went in at halftime and we was losing 6-0. And Coach Nixon went to the blackboard, and every football player in here knows what that man said. You know, I don't use that kind of language now. Especially on Sunday morning. But he went through his razzle-dazzle and he was seemed to be pointing directly at me. He said, M. Gilmer, you're not taking out your man. You're not running the pass patterns right. What's wrong with you? And I sit there. I wasn't paying that dude no mind because I knew somewhere under a water bucket, under some towels, lay the answer to all our problems. He got through and went out and slammed that door. And I winked at Pee-wee. Pee-wee followed me and we went behind the wall where the little boys go. And I took out the vinegar ball and my miracle drug. North Carolina corn. They say sometime it registers 190 to 200 proof. I remember drinking half of that contents of that bottle. And I felt that warm glow and that feeling of superiority. The same glow that I felt my first drink a few weeks before. And Pee-wee put the top on that bottle and started to put it back under those towels. And I said, hold it, Pee-wee. Hold it. This is an important game. If we lose this game, it's all over. Now, if this much makes me feel this good, give me that ball, boy. And I drunk the rest of that moonshine, and I trotted back out on that field like a black stag. Over on in the third quarter, the other team threw the pass, and me and my liquor went after it. We intercepted that pass, and I took off. I was weaving. I was bobbing. I was looking good. It was only one thing wrong. I was going the wrong damn way. I heard a voice above the crowd say, M, no, no, M. Wrong goal, M. And I reversed that feeling. You know, we alcoholics, we can't stand no down, you know, nothing like this. I reversed that feel. And I ran through all 21 of those players. And I made a touchdown. We went on to win that game 13-6. And when I got back down in the corner of the Greensboro Daily News, this is what it said. M. Gilmer runs 185 yards. You know, any rational thinking person would have stopped drinking. Not me. I wasn't about to give up this newfound miracle. And to make a long story short, I can tell you this morning. From that day on, everything that I did, if alcohol was included, turned out to be a tragedy. 1940. They tell me they drafted 10 million men to put old Hitler, Mussolini, and Tojo in their place. And I was one of them. But you know, when I found out that they wasn't going to let me be General MacArthur's assistant. Oh yes, I got drunk at them. And I don't tell all the episodes that I went through in that army with alcohol because they still might come and get me. But I truly believe if they hadn't discharged me that first year, we'd have lost that damn war. Alcohol. Alcoholism. I didn't know anything about alcoholism. I look at the beautiful people now in these treatment centers. You're lucky people. I look at the commercials on the radio. I look at the ads in the papers telling us what's wrong with us. We didn't have that back in those days. I knew something was wrong with old M. Gilmer, but I didn't know what. I remember leaving New York where I was living and coming to the Roanoke Valley. And I think they call that a geographical cure. I was hoping that I could find in that beautiful valley some help with this problem you said I had. You see, I didn't think I had a problem. Every episode I counted as a streak of bad luck. I remember I came here and I went to work for the VA. And it wasn't long before the people in the Roanoke Valley found out something strange was wrong with him. You know, alcohol made me mean. I noticed that guy in the show the other night. He said he was B-A-D, bad. That's what alcohol did to me. But if you catch me sober, I was the biggest coward in the world. So therefore, it wasn't many days or many minutes or many hours that I didn't have some alcohol in me to keep me. So I could keep up that phony front. Tragedy started to strike me early in the Roanoke Valley. I started to get into problems and have problems with the law. I started to have problems on my job. But I never contributed these problems to alcohol. I contributed to everything but. I had accepted alcohol as my personal friend, and I guess my savior. You know, me and my alcohol, we used to talk to each other. I don't know about y'all, but I liked my alcohol so much that I would sit my bottle up on the dresser, and I would actually talk to that bottle. One day I was getting ready to go to work, and me and my alcohol was talking to each other, And my alcohol said, "M, maybe you should get married." Jugan talked about that last night. It say maybe if you had some responsibility, you make this good money with the government and you don't do nothing with it but drink it up and throw it away, maybe you ought to get married. And right away, my intellect and my brilliance, along with my bowel, we started to set up certain criteria for this lucky female that was going to get this big hunk of flesh. Number one, she was going to have to be beautiful. I only had to look in the mirror one time to know I didn't want to go around through life carrying, ugly as I was, carrying something ugly on my arm. So she was going to have to be beautiful. The criteria number two was that she was going to have to be smart. I hated dumb people. You see, by this time I was chief steward of the union. Over 1,800 black and white people at this big medical facility. She was going to have to be able to meet the senators and congressmen and the union officials that I dealt with. Yes, she was going to have to be smart. But last but not least, she was going to have to be obedient. You see, I had saw so many marriages break up. That's one reason I hadn't married at this age, 30-some years old, maybe 40. And I thought that I was one of the smartest people, as long as I had my alcohol. And if this gal that I married would just do what I wanted her to do, when I wanted her to do it, we could have the perfect marriage. Well, those of you who know Ann, that's my beautiful wife. Yes, she's beautiful. Yes, she's smart. But she's a hell of a way from being obedient. Yes, I wooed this girl into marrying me under pretense that I was a heavy drinker and not an alcoholic. But after we were married, it didn't take this wonderful woman long to find out that I was a full-fledged alcoholic and a mean one. You know, I look at this beautiful lady and I wonder why she stayed. How, during those periods of our early marriage, that she was able to see me come into that house and shoot it up with a 45 Magnum. Three beautiful girls I used to call bitches. A strong, healthy ex-Marine I used to call punks. And yet she stayed. I know now that this same God that I talked to you previously, He was working in my life then. I know why she stayed, because this higher power knew that this was the only person on this green earth that He could work through to get me here where I am this morning. And anytime I share and she's with me, I always like to publicly say, "Ann, I love you. I love you for staying with me during those critical times." You know, things start to happen in our life. I believe that in every alcoholic family, Somebody has to reach out for help. And in our case, it was Ann that reached out. I now know I was too sick and too honorary to reach out and ask for help. On Sunday evenings, about 3 o'clock, Ann would leave home. And about 6 o'clock, she would come back. I could time her by the big clock on the city hall. She wouldn't deviate over 1 or 2 minutes. This went on for about a month. And I remember I was so happy when Sunday evening came. It would give me 3 hours of unobstructed drinking. You see, a woman like Ann, she can mess up your drinking. You know, you and the boys are down in the basement with a fifth of liquor, and they're standing over you talking about you drink too much. And the money you're spending on that liquor, you could be buying something for the children. You see? But when she went away on Sunday evening, me and the boys could get in that basement and we could drink and we could pee and we could puke. We could just do what we want to do. And I'll tell you, I was really enjoying it. But you see, we alcoholics, we are jive turkeys. You see, we don't stay drunk all the time. A lot of time we play drunk. But you know, I had glimpses of sobriety back in those days. As you can look at Ann, and you can tell, Ann's 10 years younger than me. You look at Ann, and you can tell, she's beautiful now, and back then she was more beautiful. And at the height of my alcoholism, the number one priority in my life was drinking. I didn't have time for foolish things like sex. I didn't have time for foolish things like making this so-called love. Now you got a beautiful woman, 10 years younger. And you're not doing what you're supposed to do. And she's going away, staying 3 hours every Sunday. Tell you the truth, I got worried. I thought some dude out there was giving me a little help with my love affair. So one Sunday evening, I decided to follow Ann. I had an old truck, and Ann left. And you know, when Ann would go away on Sunday evening, she started looking so pretty. That's when you gals start wearing those dresses up above your knees. And Ann had the prettiest knees. And she would put on one of those dresses, and she would take that old amber hair and pull it off to the side. And she'd put on some of that blue eyeshadow. And she would spray some of that evening in Africa or Paris or some damn well. And she would and she would get in that car and she would wink at me. So I got in my old truck that Sunday evening, and I followed Ann. And lo and behold, she went over to the medical center where I worked. Well, you see, we had 23 psychiatric patients. But I wasn't too drunk to realize that they didn't stay drunk all the time. So I gave the 20 shop stewards that I was supervising an assignment. And that Monday morning, I said, now next Sunday, Ann is coming over here at 3 o'clock. I want you all to find out where she goes and what she does. The next Monday morning, I went in, and one of my better shop stewards, his name is Thomas Caffey, who's now dead from alcoholism, and he said, M. Ann indeed came through that gate. And she went over to building 10. And I said, go ahead, Catherine. And then what did she do? She went in the first floor M. And she went in a little door. And I said, well, what was behind the door? He said, I don't know. I said, well, you better hurry up and find out. He said, wait a minute, M. I remember. On that door, it had A-L-N-O-N. I said, what's that? He said, I don't know. And I said, you better hurry up and find out. But you know, we went one way and I went the other, and we found a good chaplain. And he explained to me about Al-Anon. He said, Al-Anon was a situation where people and loved ones of big honorary drunks like you come to find out how to cope. I believe that day I finally start to realize something about this problem you said I had. I remember I went home and Ann started to play what I call the Al-Anon tricks of the trade on me. I see a lot of young people here, and I think it's my duty. Joe, it's my duty to tell these young people about these Al-Anon tricks of the trade. You see, because after you have been called old SOB, and every name under the sun for years, and all at once your wife start calling you sweetie pie. You see, you could have a heart attack. You see, Ann wasn't the Al-Anon like the average Al-Anon. I've learned that. And I used to wonder, why is this gal so tricky? Why is she so tough? And around the circuit, they start calling them Black Belt Al-Anon. You know, I used to think that Ann went up in the mountain and talked to a guru, and he learned all this stuff. But I found out that she had gone down to Oklahoma, and her and this beautiful Indian maid had got together. And after listening to her yesterday, I know where she found out about those tricks. Yes, Anne started to bring this literature home, and she would put it everywhere. I remember one morning I got up, all I wanted was a bowl of cornflakes to last me to lunchtime at the Medical Foundation. And I started to put a bowl of cornflakes out, and out fell some literature. I didn't say nothing that morning. Everything was getting so nice around the house because Ann had started allowing me to just do like I please. I could get drunk, spend all my money. She wouldn't do a thing but smile. I didn't want to mess that up, so I didn't say nothing to her. The next couple of mornings, I would get up, running late, hungover, and I'd start to go in my jacket pocket to find me a cigarette, though. And there would be some literature. And I remember that morning I called Ann and I said, now let me tell you something. You can go to your Aileron or Alatron or ever what you want to call it, but you quit putting that garbage in my clothes. You're going to make me late and I'm going to lose my job. And all this woman would do was smile. I start calling it the Aileron smile. I went in the toilet one morning and I was sitting there tending my own business. And I started to unroll the toilet paper. Oh, yes, you guessed it. Out fell some of this literature. That morning I said, if this gal would go to this length, I'm going to read this doggone stuff this morning. And I got up and I locked that door and I wasn't going to let her catch me reading that stuff. And lo and behold, it was the 20 questions. Oh, everybody here knows about those 20 questions. I read those questions through. And then I read them again and again. And before I finished reading them, tears was running down my face. I said, my God, I must be one of those things. You see, I thought an alcoholic was one of the lowest down things on God's green earth. I thought they was honorary, shiftless, no good. We had a program there at the Medical Foundation, and I used to treat those guys like dirt. The very idea of them giving them all that good juice and milk, and they would be eating steaks while the other patient was eating hamburgers. I didn't like alcoholics. But lo and behold, those 20 questions was telling old M. Gilmer in no uncertain terms, yes, you're an alcoholic, and you've been one for a long, long time. I remember I came out of that bathroom that morning, and this smart lady propositioned me. She said, M., you know, I told you I was going to leave you. But if you'll do and grant me a request, I'll consider staying. I want you to come straight home this evening. I've got two men I want you to talk to. I said, no sweat, honey. And she started out the door and she looked back and she said, don't drink. Brothers and sisters, it's been years since I've gone 24 hours without alcohol of some kind in my body. That day at the medical center was one of the most horrible days that I've ever spent. I was determined that I was going home and keep the commitment to the only woman, person, or thing that I'd ever loved on this earth. Let me quickly describe to you what happened at the end of my tour duty. I started home, and I'm only 10 minutes away from the Medical Foundation. And it seemed like it was some little men down deep inside of my being. And seemed like they had on golf shoes, Joe. They had on golf shoes. And they started to stomp, and they started to scrape. And a little voice came up out of my esophagus and said, M, get a drink, fool. You're going to die. And I said, like heck I will. I'm going home to my love. And just before I got home, it's a dead-end street. To the right, I could go home and keep my commitment to this lovely lady. And to my left was the bootleg joint. Every alcoholic here knows which way I went. It was that day that I learned that I was indeed powerless over alcohol and that my life was truly unmanageable. I knew then that I was a slave to alcohol. You see, up until that time, I told my boss, my lawyer, the doctors, I can take it or leave it. But that day I found out that I had been lying to myself. I went and got a dollar drink and I made it home, and sitting in my living room were two men. And they told me about this fabulous program. They told me they too were alcoholics. And they had been down in the deep pits of alcoholism. And you know, I thought those two of the biggest liars that I've ever heard in my life. Here two dudes were sitting in my house with botany $500 suits on, shoes shined to perfection, a new Buick Riviera sitting in my driveway, and they were telling me that they were in the same boat that I was. But when they finished, I told them, thank you. If I need you, I'll call you. And I talked during the end, and I said, thank you for sending for those men, hon. They made me aware of what's wrong with me. I've been drinking the wrong brand. And she gave me the Al-Anon smile, because she knew that the time was near. She knew that alcohol in any form was going to do the same thing. The same thing that any other alcohol had done. It was going to make me crazy. It was going to make me arrogant. And it was going to make me mistreat people like I'd done for so many years. In the next 2 weeks, Ann really tried to help me reach my bottom. I remember one day she was going out to the plaza and she said, Em, I'm going down to the plaza, hon. Is anything I can do for you or bring you? I said, no, Ann, I'm okay. She said, I'm going right by the liquor store. And I said, oh my God, she's going to poison me. She never had offered to bring me no liquor. But then there came a weekend when I was drinking Johnny Walker Red Scotch. And my Johnny Walker Red Scotch ran out. And I went out to my bootleg joint and I mixed it with corn. And I had my first case of DTs. A few weeks ago, a guy told me point blank, M, you can just go to hell. And I said, please don't tell me that. I've already been. Have you ever had the DTs? Yes. It's a living hell. I remember calling up Ann on her job and I said, honey, send for those men. I surrender. Alcohol had beat me to my knees. And they came and they took me to my first AA meeting at Salem Presbyterian Church, a so-called white church. I didn't know there were a lot of black people in that church. But they took us and we went into the basement and there was 50 white people at this meeting. And I got in a chair back near the door in case I needed to make an emergency exit. But I remember that night up behind that rostrum, a dude got up there and he told us how rotten his life had been, what he did, and how sweet it was. Living in AA and working these steps. I remember on the way home, I looked over at Ann and she was all smiles. Have you ever seen Al-Anon the first night she get a drunk to a meeting? Boy, they are happy people. And I looked at Ed and I said, honey, did you notice something strange about that meeting? And she said, no, Em. I said, did you notice when no more us there? Everybody I knew drunk liquor, beat the wife and pawned the suit. And then go to work on Monday morning. And I said, if I got to go to those meetings, why is it that some of them ain't there? And this beautiful gal said to me, Em, God just has to reveal to these unfortunate people about this fabulous program. You know, I love Dan, and I didn't want her to leave me. But I wasn't about to leave something of this importance to Ann. I decided to go talk to the smartest people in the Roanoke Valley. I went out to my bootleg joint. And I hit that table, and they had a half a gallon of moonshine sitting on that table. And I said, hold it up here, the captain's here. I went up to a meeting up to the white church last night. And a guy got up behind a roster, and he told us how rotten his life had been, what he did and what he did about it now. And he called it AA. Do any of y'all know anything about it? And one of my dear friends, who was also dead from alcoholism, and his name was Roughhouse, and he spoke up and he said, Em, don't you go back up there no more, boy. And I said, why not, Roughhouse? He said, Em, you might have sickle cell anemia, but you can't be no alcoholic. Don't you know that alcoholism is a white man's disease? Boy, I'm telling you, I was the happiest dude in the world. I went home and I woke Ann up. I said, wake up, girl. Ruffall said alcoholism is a white man's disease. I ain't got to go back to no more of them old meetings. And she said, the heck with Ruffall. We going back. I'm so glad she made that decision. Because we went back. And I started to hear what you beautiful people were saying. I started to comprehend what you were saying when you said the serenity prayer. I used to love to hear the chairman get up behind this rostrum and he would say, rarely have we seen a person fail who's thoroughly followed our path. And I used to sit back at the back and sitting on my hands and I say, gee, there's a chance for me. I started to like what I was hearing at these meetings. And you all took me in as one of you all. The first thing time in my life that I'd ever belonged to anything worthwhile. You all started letting me empty ashtrays. And you started to let me make coffee. And I got me a sponsor, and he started telling me about service work, Joe. He said, Em, you're going to get out of this AA thing exactly what you put in it. And he drummed that in my head. And about 2 years after then, you all had an election. And you elected me Secretary Treasurer. You see, that was a miracle in itself. Hadn't nobody let me get close to no money in 20 years. Oh, yes. That made me to the point that I want to share my three miracles with you. I've had lots of miracles since I came into this program. But if three stands out in my memory this morning, and the miracle of discovery. I had discovered a program. I discovered a program with 12 steps and 12 traditions that was going to make me well. The miracle of discovery. And the second miracle was the miracle of recovery. Doing this service work. Doing discussions. Doing the fellowship. I was getting well. The police around the Roanoke Valley, they started to wave at me. And say hello to him instead of throwing me in jail. My dog stopped trying to bite me. And a day never passed that Ann and those beautiful girls didn't tell me that they loved me. I remember one Father's Day, I heard Ann ask the girls and my boy, did y'all get him a present? And they said, oh, Mama, we forgot. But just the thrill of knowing that they were thinking about giving this old drunk a present was a thrill to me. But one of my daughters, she's very artistic. She sat down that night and she made me a homemade Father's Day card. And I never will forget that morning I woke up and I read that card. And this is what it said. Let me share. Roses are red. Violets are blue. Daddy, since you quit drinking, we love you. Oh, boy. If there was anything in my mind about going back to the life, that changed my mind. I love this life I was living. I love this service work. I loved the fellowship. And one night, it happened. A blonde girl with blue eyes came up and put her arms around me and she said, M, we love you. And I said, what did you say? She said, M, we love you. And I decided that night that I was going out to talk to the smartest people in the Roanoke Valley and tell them about this thing. And I wouldn't tell them about this blonde girl with blue eyes putting her arms around me and telling me that she loved me. And one of my drunken friends spoke up and said, the Ku Klux Klan rides again. What these poor drunks didn't know, that this girl wasn't talking about that old funny kind of love. That old Hollywood love. She was talking about a special love that every speaker at this conference has said something about. An unconditional love. A love with no strings attached. A love that has nothing to do with sex, race, color or creed or social standing. She was talking about the love that we find in AA and Al-Anon and Alteen. The kind of love that glues us together. The kind of love that makes us go to any length to help each other find sobriety and to keep that sobriety. I found that kind of love everywhere that I've ever gone. God has blessed me to travel this country and parts of Canada, attending meetings and conferences and sharing. And every meeting and conference and roundup that I've ever gone to, I found this kind of unconditional love. Oh, yes. I find that love here. I've felt it ever since the day I walked into this hotel. And I know this morning, as long as I feel this kind of love and stay close to people like you, I have nothing, nothing to worry about. You know, my dear mother, she used to wash clothes down in the backyard in North Carolina. And she had a song that she used to sing. And I used to wonder, why did she sing that song over and over and over again? And she would sing, I come to the garden alone, while the dew is still on the roses. He walks with me, and he talks with me, and he tells me that I'm his own. Devil, where mama is today, I wanted to know. I know what she was singing about. That's the feeling I have this morning. Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found. I was blind, but now I see. I get on these spiritual highs, and I like to walk out in the mornings and look at the sunrise. And I like to say, come on, world. Come on. Come on with your heartaches. Come on with your disappointments. Go ahead, you HUD officials. Steal all the money. Go ahead. Give all our money to the Contras. It's all right. Go ahead and raise our taxes, because it ain't nothing you can put on me today that me and God can't take care of. I believe the promises found on page 83 and 84 that God is going to supply all of our needs. The only thing I need to do is work these 12 steps. The 12 traditions, one day at a time, and hang out with people like you. You know, I believe that everyone under the sound of my voice, we are truly blessed. I believe that the light of God surrounds us. The love of God enfolds us. The power of God protects us. And the presence of God watches over us. Because wherever we are, God is, and all is well. And now this imaginary cake that I've placed before this roster sits there in all its majesty. The icing has been put on. Now I know what I've got to contribute. You know, a cake is not beautiful until you write something on it. And I want to write on the top of this beautiful Atlanta Roundup cake, God loves you.